Madam.
And now Mr. Searle will bring us up to date on the oil situation.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. It is, I'm sure, simply a coincidence that we're meeting at a center of make-believe and fantasy, and that the whole matter of fuel supply in the last year has assumed some unreal qualities. I missed Bob Sandberg's talk this noon, which I assumed was excellent. I'll have to talk to him when we get back to Palo Alto about what I understand was some comment about economists. I'll leave it to your own judgment, though, as to what caused you the real trouble. If it's the economists, or if it's the communications, the piles of paper in your inbox and the telephones. That's surely my trouble, the communications, not the economists. And I've got to agree with Mr. Gunning, it's barrels of oil, Joe, not tons of coal. In considering oil supply for power generation, one must place considerable emphasis on crude oil supply. If there are shortages of crude oil, this means almost certainly shortages of oil for power generation. Oil for power generation is not likely to receive a high priority in a period of shortages. Witness, for example, the recent attempts to convert plants which had been converted from coal to oil back to coal again in the recent times of shortage. I was going to give you a few remarks here about the future growth of electricity. Mr. Gunning's done a good job with that, so I will skip that. But let me point out that in the past, a lot of places in our economy, and I think in power generation to some extent too, we've tended to use oil as the swing fuel, the fuel which you could get more or less of rather easily. That may not be true in the future, and the oil requirements are very uncertain then, because I think the electricity requirements are somewhat uncertain. Certainly looking out towards 1985, if electricity falls short, there will be a real tendency, short of projections, a real tendency to continue to load the big nuclear plants and the baseload coal-fired plants and to cut back on oil consumption to the extent that we can. I would like to approach the subject of oil first by talking about expectations for oil supply in general and oil for power generation in particular as they existed before the Arab embargo, and then to look at how these expectations should now be modified in the light of the embargo and subsequent developments. Reports published by the National Petroleum Council as part of their study of the U.S. energy outlook may be taken as typical of pre-embargo expectations. The National Petroleum Council identified four main supply options by which its intermediate demand case might be met. The role of oil differed considerably in the four cases, even though total energy consumption was the same. At the one extreme was the option under which national policy resulted in a continuation of the decline in the development of domestic energy resources, a decline which has been going on for well over a decade. Under this option, foreign oil was expected to make up for an increasing deficiency in domestic energy output, not only of oil, but of all other energy forms. As a result, oil consumption in 1985 was the highest, in this case, of any of the four cases. 50% of total energy consumed was consumed as oil. At the other extreme was the case where the U.S. made a determined effort to increase domestic energy output. This is the case that now most clearly approximates the situation under Project Independence, although national policy, as Joe Brennan has noted, is still somewhat ambiguous about the development of domestic supply. In this National Petroleum Council case, oil would supply only 34% of energy consumption in 1985 due to increased output of coal and other fuels. The Electricity Task Force of the National Petroleum Council study analyzed the sources of energy for electric power generation. This task force found that oil consumed for electric power generation in 1985 might be anywhere from 200% of the 1970 consumption level to nearly 800% of the 1970 level. This is a very wide range indeed. It reflects both some technological uncertainty and the fact that we have tended to use oil as a swing fuel in the United States, one that could be called upon on relatively short notice to make up the deficiency in the supply of other fuels or to meet surges in consumption. The task force judged that the most likely level of utility oil consumption in 1985 would be from 200 to 300% of the 1970 level. A 1973 pre-embargo study by L.G. Cook of Esso Research and Engineering tended to support the oil consumption levels toward the middle of the NPC range. According to Cook's study, not only would there be a rapid growth in oil consumption by electric utilities, but much of the growth in this consumption would be for distillate-type fuel oil rather than for residual oil. Cook expected the use of distillate oil by electric utilities would grow from less than 100,000 barrels per day in 1973 to 3 million barrels per day in 1985 and 6 million barrels per day in 1990. To this must be added, of course, use of residual oil, which, as was mentioned, ran 1.5 million barrels per day last year, and which, under pre-embargo circumstances, would have increased through the years and probably still will to some extent. Cook's estimate of 3 million barrels of distillate oil consumption in 1985 was based on the ordering by utilities of large amounts of combination gas turbine, steam turbine capacity to meet the intermediate load and to ensure against shortages of capacity in nuclear and coal-fired plants coming on the line. It appears from Cook's charts that over 20% of total capacity in 1985 would be in combination units. I don't have much feel whether this is realistic or not. Probably most of you are in a better position to judge it than I am. It's a definite change, though, from the past. Cook does point out, correctly I believe, that it will be increasingly uneconomic and unwise technically to use large nuclear base units and supercritical fossil fuel plants to serve the intermediate or swing load. In the past, older fossil units could be used to serve this load, but this will be less and less feasible in the future. And there is a real question as to how this load will indeed be supplied. Oil or natural gas is, from a technical standpoint, a logical choice for the capacity to serve this intermediate load. But as was mentioned here, gas is increasingly being phased out of the power plant market, and whether or not oil will be available is a major question. The Arab oil embargo has changed or at least clouded the outlook for oil. With regard to availability of oil supply, ignoring price for the moment, drilling for oil in the United States is increasing as rapidly as the supply of labor, steel, and drilling rigs will allow. As best I can tell, activity is not being hampered by any lack of places to drill. This does not mean that domestic oil supply will increase particularly in the next few years. Without any new drilling, domestic oil production would decline at the rate of perhaps 10% per year. It may take several years to get domestic drilling up to the level where it can offset the natural decline in production and result in a net increase in output. The future of domestic oil is still subject to many political and environmental uncertainties, just as is the case with coal. Since many of the better prospects for new oil are on federal lands, federal leasing policy is a key element. Although the rate of leasing offshore areas was inadequate a few years ago, the Department of Interior is moving towards a near-term goal of leasing 10 million acres a year. This should be adequate, at least if the department leases the areas in which the industry is ready to work. Price policy is another element of uncertainty in the oil picture, in spite of the dramatic increases in prices we've had in recent months. New supplies are developed on the basis of price and profit expectations, not on the basis of current prices. Even though I would judge present domestic prices for new oil to be adequate, continued control of old oil prices creates doubts and will in the long run, if continued, either decrease the rate at which new capacity is developed, below that which would otherwise prevail, or require an additional risk premium in the price and consequently a higher price. Petroleum tax policy is still another area of uncertainty. If petroleum prices are free to regulation, then it probably makes little difference to the development of new supply whether potential tax treatment is retained, whether preferential tax treatment is retained or not. And some oil companies are even advocating elimination of the depletion allowance. Probably the most important thing in tax policy with regards to oil is get the policy settled promptly, whichever way the decision goes, so that new investment decisions can be made without the uncertainty brought on by this element. A particularly important policy affecting domestic oil development will be oil import policy. For many years, Middle East oil producers will have the capability to grossly undercut domestic oil in the U.S. market. The need to protect against this contingency is generally voiced in connection with the development of synthetic fuels. However, it is probably even more important as far as domestic crude oil development is concerned. At a given price, domestic oil producers will, if they act rationally, invest less without such protection than they will with it. Having just gotten rid of controls on imported oil, it will be hard to reimpose them, and I doubt if we will. It will probably be easier politically to allow the price of domestic oil to include a risk premium for the possible breakup of the cartel of oil exporting countries. Unfortunately, I'm not predicting the breakup of the oil cartel, but some people still believe it is possible and it could happen. Turning now to environmental restrictions on the expansion of domestic oil production, we appear to be past the peak of environmental delays. Unfortunately, I'm not sure whether this is true for our industry, and Joe just made it clear he's not sure whether it's true for the coal industry or not. But I think for oil, we're probably past the peak of the environmental problem. The decision to go ahead with the Trans-Alaska pipeline probably marked the turning point for oil. It also looks like development in the Santa Barbara Channel will be resumed. There may still be some controversy over development in the offshore Atlantic region, but it looks like the offshore areas will be leased with perhaps some restrictions. Environmental protection will add increasingly to the cost of development of new domestic oil, but environmental delays should be diminished. The first big increase in domestic output will come with the completion of the Alaskan pipeline from the North Slope of Alaska to Valdez. Within a year or two of its completion, this line may increase domestic output up to 20%. About the same time, the results of drilling in some of the better prospective areas should begin to add substantially to domestic supply, with the result that domestic production of crude oil and natural gas liquids might be as much as 16 million barrels per day by 1985, as compared to 11 million barrels per day in 1973. Those of you who have been reading the predictions that the U.S. oil industry is on the downgrade may find this somewhat startling. However, given the higher prices for oil which we now have, proper leasing policies and other policies getting settled, I think there's little question but what we can meet a 16 million barrel per day oil output in 1985. However, even 16 million barrels per day of output does not quite match our current oil consumption levels, let alone predicted 1985 levels. The effect of conservation efforts and higher oil prices will, in my opinion, definitely reduce the projected levels of demand. But, as Mr. Gunning indicated, demand is still going to continue to grow. It is likely then, in my opinion anyway, that even in 1985, even with Project Independence, we will be importing at least several million barrels per day of oil from foreign sources, and perhaps considerably more. Now, what about the availability of this foreign oil? There's a question of both the availability and the price of imported oil in the future. A number of exporting nations are talking about permanent limitations on their production rates. There are a number of reasons for this. Some nations are seriously concerned about conserving oil for their own use. Others who have very large amounts of oil resources feel that from an investment standpoint, it is wiser to limit production and stretch production out over a period of many years. Others feel that the Western world has simply been consuming too much of the world's resources at an unwise rate and believe that we may need assistance in curbing our appetite. And still others may be motivated by political reasons or attempts to bargain for higher current oil prices. Any attempt to unravel the foreign oil puzzle is beyond the scope of this paper. I may note, however, that an increasing number of oil experts are now predicting a near-term world surplus of oil, arising largely from the depressing effect of higher prices on consumption, and particularly on consumption in the developing nations. In economic theory, this should depress world oil prices. I am not sure, however, that we are in a situation where economics is the dominant force. In the world oil market, Middle East politics and nationalism play a large role. I doubt if world oil prices or U.S. oil prices will decline much in constant dollars, although some think this is possible. On the other hand, I have considerable confidence in the ability of the oil industry to expand supply in the United States and in new foreign areas if given the chance. Consequently, I do not visualize much higher domestic or foreign oil prices in constant dollars through 1985. How am I doing on time? 3 minutes, okay. In the near term, the Federal Energy Agency is expected to free residual oil from allocations for a 90-day trial period. It seems likely that increasing amounts of both residual and distillate oil will be available for utility use in the future with certain provisos. In the case of distillate oils in particular, there could be problems with refinery capacity in the next few years, particularly if we should have abnormally cold winters. As I mentioned initially, we can expect that federal authorities would give priority to residential and commercial users of distillate over utility usage. There could consequently be periods in which utilities could not get all the distillate they need. Residual oil is subject to the proviso that foreign supplies are not interrupted by a successful boycott or international conflict. Additions to refinery capacity approaching 4 million barrels per day are scheduled in the United States through 1977. These should do much to provide additional distillate production capacity, providing that refiners are properly informed about or properly anticipate utility requirements for distillate, so that the refining capacity is designed for appropriate yields of distillate. This may, of course, be a problem, since, as I indicated previously, there is considerable uncertainty about the distillate requirements of utilities. We are, however, for the foreseeable future, in a situation where it will pay to arrange for fuel supplies as soon as the type of capacity is identified, whether it's coal, oil, or nuclear. The days of buying spot coal, cheap uranium, and of uncommitted oil are increasingly a thing of the past. I've talked somewhat here about the intermediate load and the like. One of the possibilities, and one which is being studied carefully at the electric power research industry, is the development of storage systems which will allow the use of more of the nuclear plants and more baseload fossil fuel plants around the clock and cut out the need for some of the intermediate capacity. This would interact with oil requirements and somewhat reduce the need for oil in the utility market. However, I tend to be somewhat pessimistic about the rate at which this new storage capacity can be added, and I doubt very much if it will make a major contribution within the next decade about which we're talking here. In summary, I would say the oil supply looks pretty fluid to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Searle. Now, Mr. Landis will talk to us on the nuclear situation. Okay.
Thank you, Howard. I'd like to start out by trying to solve this argument that's going on here about units. I'd like to propose pounds of uranium, but maybe pounds of beer would be better. To illustrate a little bit at the outset what my attitude is towards the energy controversy that's going on, I'll tell you a little story about the lion at the waterhole in Africa. Seems there was an old lion who drank at the same waterhole in Africa every night, so much so that he thought he owned the waterhole. So every night after he drank, he would lie down in the path leading down to the waterhole, and accost any animal that came along. Well, this one night, a zebra came along. And the lion rose up and said in his deepest voice, "Who's the king of beasts?" The zebra said, "Why, you are, sir," very obsequiously. And the lion said, "You may pass and drink." Next, a tiny gazelle came along. And the lion rose up and said, "Who's the king of beasts?" And the gazelle was so frightened, almost collapsed. But it finally came out with the right answer. And the lion said, "You may pass and drink." Next came along a 6-ton bull elephant. And the lion came up to his full height, roared in its very loudest voice, "Who's the king of beasts?" That bull elephant had a bad day, picked him up in his trunk, tossed him back in the jungle. Lion limped back to the edge of the jungle and yelled out, "Just because you don't know the answer, you don't have to get so damn mad." What I've chosen to talk about today is the nuclear fuel challenge of the 1980s. Now, most of the commercial nuclear power plants in operation in the United States in the 1980s will be light water reactors. The remainder will be high-temperature gas-cooled reactors. Both of these reactor types have conversion ratios of less than unity and therefore are net consumers of uranium. The former produces about half as much fuel as it consumes, the latter about two-thirds. During the next 15 years, the nation's nuclear electric generating capacity will increase rapidly from about 26,000 megawatts today to about 100,000 megawatts in 1980 to about 460,000 megawatts in 1990. This means that the plutonium and U-233 bred in LWRs and HTGRs, respectively, will contribute little to the total nuclear fuel requirements of the 1980s. Most of these requirements will have to be satisfied by mining, milling, purifying, transforming, enriching, and fabricating virgin uranium. Recognizing this, we are face to face with the challenges my subject refers to. They include finding and producing the vast amount of U-308 required, chemically transforming this U-308 to UF6, enriching the UF6, fabricating enriched uranium into high-quality fuel elements at a reasonable cost, transporting and reprocessing spent fuel elements at a reasonable cost, disposing of the radioactive waste, safeguarding both enriched uranium and the secondary fuels bred in the fertile material associated with that enriched uranium, and finally, raising the necessary capital for these expensive undertakings. Obviously, I do not have time to discuss all of these challenges. Weighing my desire to give you a comprehensive picture against my orders to stay within the time limit allotted to me, I've decided to concentrate on the three challenges that appear to be the most important, and they are: first, finding and producing the vast amount of uranium required. Second, enriching this uranium. Finally, safeguarding both enriched uranium and bred fuels. And if you disagree with my selections, I'd certainly like to hear your thoughts in the discussion period. On top of its other woes, the nuclear power industry is now suffering rampant and rather erratic escalation of uranium ore prices. The basic reason for this is that proven ore reserves are not adequate to meet the demand of the early 1980s, and utility companies who are operating or building nuclear power plants are scrambling to tie up enough fuel to keep their plants going through the next decade. A secondary reason is that the AEC now requires fixed delivery of uranium in order to obtain enrichment services. Market conditions are rather chaotic at present, to put it mildly. Not only domestic, but also foreign utility companies are requesting quotations from U.S. suppliers. In some cases, foreign buyers are offering to pay substantially higher prices than domestic buyers. The current price range in the spot market is therefore quite wide, from $11 to $16 per pound. This variation will narrow markedly by the end of the year, I believe. That's the good news. The bad news is that it will probably home in on the upper end of the scale. There are other reasons besides inadequate proven reserves and the recent changes in AEC enrichment policy for these chaotic market conditions, however. Among them are the even faster price increases for competing fuels, coal, oil, and gas, and the general unavailability of these fuels for generation of electricity at the present time. Also, the marginal producers that were enticed into the business by the booming market of the 1960s have now all but disappeared from the scene thus reducing competition. Add to these factors the increased difficulty in locating and developing new ore bodies and the effects of the spiraling inflation the world is suffering, and you have a bad scene. Enough of a challenge to make even a modern Hercules ponder before undertaking it. Utility companies are not the only organizations being hurt by the unsettled uranium ore market. Manufacturers of nuclear fuel are also being hurt, particularly those who are short in their U-308 requirements. They are short only because they counted on buying uranium when needed at a price below the sum of what they would have had to pay earlier, plus normal carrying charges. But uranium prices have escalated much faster than expected and are now well beyond that sum. This could spell trouble for certain manufacturers unless the price of uranium comes back down. There will be occasional downward turns in the price of uranium, but generally the trend will be up, for all the reasons I have mentioned. Even small decreases in price over a period of a year could have disastrous effects on certain manufacturers, however. Take the case of the company that buys its uranium at the last minute for a large throughput, say 5,000 tons. If the average price of this ore goes down $1 per pound during that year, the company must absorb an inventory loss of $10 million, which could wipe out its entire profit on those cores. If we had open worldwide trading for yellowcake and a futures market to boot, it would be relatively easy for both utility companies and manufacturers to protect themselves from the risks that I've outlined. We have neither of these commercial arrangements, however, and the organizations in the nuclear fuel business are therefore forced to speculate. Part of the challenge I'm talking about is to set up open worldwide trading and a futures market. Now, the uranium business wasn't always this bad. How and why did it deteriorate? I think that history tells the tale. From the inception of the uranium mining and milling industry in 1948 until the early 1960s, the AEC was the sole purchaser of uranium and negotiated prices on the basis of production costs. In 1956, the AEC announced a uniform price of $8 per pound for producers under government contract and gave the industry permission to make commercial sales, both policies to be effective in 1962. These policies were indeed put into effect that year. The $8 price was originally scheduled to be terminated in 1966, but a stretch-out program extended it, in certain cases, to 1970. Commercial sales began in 1967. Prices fell to about $5 per pound shortly thereafter and were still as low as $6 per pound for near-term deliveries in early 1973, just last year. Then the lid blew off. Environmental restraints eliminated the possibility of large increases in the use of conventional fuels to solve the energy crisis. Sales of nuclear power plants boomed. Rampant inflation raised the cost of everything, including exploring for and producing uranium ore. Good uranium deposits became harder to find. The current average price of, say, $13 per pound will probably rise to $16 per pound by the end of the year, as I've indicated. In 1980, it will probably be $25 per pound, and these are all constant dollars. I've mentioned two ways to tackle the uranium problem: open worldwide trading and a futures market. These do not get to the heart of the matter, however. That can be done only by finding and developing much more ore than we are consuming. In other words, increasing supply above demand. And this is the other part of the challenge I'm talking about. And what are your prospects if you decide to quit your engineering job today and go out looking for uranium? Very dim. The business of finding and developing uranium ore bodies has become unbelievably sophisticated and expensive. For example, it costs five times as much to drill exploratory holes today as it did 10 years ago. For another example, the measures an owner must take to protect uranium miners from health hazards have run extraction costs up threefold over those in 1965. Discovery of new uranium deposits in the United States during the past 3 years has barely kept up with production. Both concentration and use of both concentration and size of new finds are trending downward. The foreign picture is similar, except in Australia. South African production is largely tied to its production of gold. As the price of gold rises, lower and lower grade ores are mined. These ores are also low in uranium content. Therefore, since there is no incentive to increase uranium milling capacity, less uranium ore is produced. The Rössing deposit,